Hello and welcome to the History of the Germans, episode 143, The Murder of a King, Albrecht I von Habsburg. The late 13th century was the sniper's alley for many a powerful family. The disappearance of great dynasties, the Arpads of Hungary, the Premyslitz of Bohemia, the Zähringer Babenbergs, the Counts of Holland, to name just a few, wasn't down to lack of fertility, but down to violence. Murder had become so common, even those who did not have swords sticking out of their chest were presumed poisoned. To save them, some were suspended from the ceiling to flush out harmful substances. And violence was not limited to temporal princes. Even the Pope was getting slapped down for declaring that every Christian ruler was subject to the Roman pontiff. The fact that Albrecht I von Habsburg, the new king of the Romans, was murdered is therefore not the most interesting thing about him. What is astonishing is how far this man, with only one eye and a look that made you sick, got in his ambitions. Pressured from all sides, the prince electors, his own vassals in Austria, the Pope, the Bohemians, still he ploughed on, picking up principalities like others were picking daisies. And a wreath of daisies is what did for him in the end. Before we start the story proper, I want to thank not only the patrons who keep this show on the road by signing up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans or by making a one-time donation at historyofthegermans.com/support, but I want to break a lance for all of you who keep supporting the show by telling friends and family about it, by posting on social media and particularly on Facebook and Twitter, or by reading and commenting on my website. Our podcast, like the History of the Germans, experiences some serious level of attrition. Of the 70,000 people who've listened to the first episode, only about half are still on board by episode 4, and by episode 17 that has halved again to 20,000, and in the long run, less than 17% stick around. That's about 11,000 people now, and of those, an estimated 20% drop out every 6 months. That means just to stay level, the show needs to bring in 4,000 new listeners per year. Which means we need almost 30,000 people trying the History of the Germans for the first time every year. Now, I do my very best to drum up listeners by posting on Facebook at HotGPod and on Twitter at Germans History, but I'm struggling to find new audiences there. I tried the other platforms, but I had little success so far. Cross-promotion with other podcasters helps a bit, but it is sporadic and limited by the fact that I only recommend podcasts I actually listen to myself. In other words, I need your help. If every one of you gets 3 people to try the History of the Germans, well, that would translate into more than 4,000 new permanent listeners, enough to cover the ongoing attrition. In other words, I need your help. If every one of you gets 3 people to try the History of the Germans, that would translate into 4,000 new permanent listeners, enough to cover more than the ongoing attrition. So please, go and tell your friends, your family, your colleagues, your butcher, your baker, your candlestick maker that you like the History of the Germans podcast and that they should try it. And as a special inducement, in 2 episodes' time, I will call out the 5 fans who sent me the longest list of friends, family, acquaintances and random people on the street that have asked to listen to the show. And if you do take part, let me know whether I should call out your full name or just your name and initial. Talking about calling out names, I want to say some special thanks to my patrons, Larry A, Paul Caldwell, Miriam A, Matt H, Emily P, and Ben S, who've already signed up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans. So now, finally, back to the show. Now last week, we ended with the Battle of Göllheim on July 2, 1298. The deposed King Adolf von Nassau was dead. Albrecht I, oldest son of King Rudolf of Habsburg, was finally elected King of the Romans. 6 weeks later, he was crowned in Aachen by the Archbishop of Cologne. Albrecht had supposed to become king 7 years earlier, upon the death of his father King Rudolf, but that did not happen in part because the prince electors, the Archbishops of Cologne, Mainz, Trier, the King of Bohemia, the Duke of Saxony, the Markgraf of Brandenburg and the Count Palatinate on the Rhine had entered into a new modus operandi, where the son of a king was not to become king. Full stop. But in 1298 they had no option to deny Albrecht the crown any longer, It was either that or leaving Adolf of Nassau in charge, and Adolf had become unacceptable to the electors. Adolf had broken all the promises he had made to them in the run-up to his election, promises that tied him down to be nothing but a tool in the hands of the electors. Not only that, his successful campaigns in Thuringia and Meissen had made it likely that he too would elevate his family to become imperial princes, and quite frankly, where would that end? So Albrecht became the elector's champion in removing Adolf von Nassau. And that champion he may have been, but whether they really liked or actually supported him, well, that was a different question. Past historians had often ascribed Albrecht's difficulty first to be elected and then to gather support for his policies to his appearance and personality. Contemporaries described him as a boorish man, with only one eye and a look that made you sick, a miser who kept his money and gave nothing to the empire except for children, of which he had many. Well, he indeed had only one eye. In 1295, his physicians had taken an illness for poisoning and had suspended him upside down from the ceiling to flush out the concerning substance. As it happened, Albrecht had not been poisoned, and even more miraculously, he survived the treatment. At least most of him. The compression to the skull popped out an eyeball. So, key learning from history, do not suspend yourself from the ceiling for extended periods of time unless you are certain you have been poisoned. Now, apart from the loss of an eye, the time he was suspended from the ceiling had also been one of the politically most difficult periods for Albrecht. Why that was, we have to go back to his relative youth, when his father still sat on the throne. Albrecht had become Duke of Austria and Styria in 1282, initially jointly with his brother Rudolf, and from 1283 on his own. Even though he was the eldest son of the reigning monarch, he pursued the same territorial strategy many other imperial princes engaged in. And that policy was to centralize ducal power. And that meant removing all those special rights and privileges the towns, the cities, and the nobles held independently from the duke, either due to full unencumbered ownership or by grant from the emperor. And like every other prince, he faced some serious opposition to his efforts. Neither the cities nor the nobles were prepared to hand back their hard-earned rights. The first ones to stand up to Albrecht were the citizens of Vienna. They had demanded that Albrecht confirm their ancient privileges and threatened to declare themselves as a free imperial city if he failed to do so. But Albrecht did not yield. Instead, he had his soldiers close the bridges across the Danube, effectively closing the city off from trade and supply of food. The economy of Vienna took a severe hit. The artisans, the blacksmiths, boyers, locksmiths, goldsmiths, harness makers and knife makers, saddlers, shoemakers, needle makers, butchers, bakers, furriers, tailors, wood turners, weavers, woolen loden cloth makers, parchment makers and tanners, hatters, tailors, shield makers and binders, silk spinners, tinkers and bell founders, carpenters and stonemasons, brick makers, glaziers and mirror makers, carpenters and barrel makers, belt makers and wide tanners, glove makers, producers of horn and bone goods, coin makers, stove makers and basket weavers, they all suffered from rising prices for materials and declining demand from the impoverished citizens. As the blockade continued, the price for wood and coal increased, and finally food prices exploded. Hungry and losing faith in the patrician leadership, the lower classes took to the streets, demanding an end to the hardship. The local clergy negotiated a compromise. The patricians were to go and negotiate with the duke, and unless they found an agreement within 6 days, the plebs would hand them over to the ducal soldiers. Well, there was nothing to negotiate here. Albrecht simply dictated the terms. He took the ancient charters and cut out all the passages he did not like with a knife, well, and then confirmed the rest. The city walls were breached at strategic points, and the city returned under the now even firmer control of the duke. In 1291-92, following King Rudolf's death, Albrecht had to put down another uprising. A further challenge to his rule came at the election of the new king, Adolf of Nassau. King Wenceslas II of Bohemia had been one of the electors of Adolf of Nassau. And Wenceslas' father had held the duchies of Austria and Styria until Albrecht's father had ousted him from there. Wenceslas wanted the duchies back. So, in exchange for his vote, Wenceslas demanded that Adolf would declare the elevation of Albrecht to Duke of Austria illegal and return the duchies to Wenceslas II. As we remember, Adolf's key skill in the run-up to his election had been his ability to sign literally any piece of paper the electors put before him, and so he did that here too, and committed to Wenceslas that he would get rid of Albrecht. Albrecht managed that curveball rather well. He met with the new King Adolf, and he handed over the imperial regalia Adolf needed to make his coronation valid. In exchange, Adolf suspended any action against Albrecht. But still, his situation remained precarious. The real crisis happened in 1295 during the illness that would cost him an eye. Many believed that Albrecht was at death's door. King Adolf von Nassau thought that this was the moment to finally honor his promise to King Wenceslas of Bohemia and ordered Austria and Styria to be returned to the crown, presumably to then pass it on to Wenceslas II. And Wenceslas II then funded another uprising of the nobility in preparation of his return to Vienna. Albrecht was finally lowered from the ceiling, got into and then rose from his sickbed. He gathered his forces and put down the uprising. And in his victory, he was, however, magnanimous. He left the rebellious nobles in possession of most of their wealth and privileges in exchange for a vow of support in the now inevitable military conflict with King Adolf von Nassau. It was this policy of stick and carrot that allowed Albrecht to remain in control of the newly acquired duchies of Austria and Styria, and to finally overcome the opposition from the electors, the King of the Romans and the King of Bohemia. So, in respect of strategy and political nows, Albrecht was very much his father's son. I have not found a reference to him playing chess, but even if he didn't, he was still always a few steps ahead of his adversaries. But what he lacked was Rudolf's interpersonal skills. Contemporaries praised Rudolf's friendliness, his affable manner and humility that camouflaged his ruthlessness. In Albrecht, his ambition and severity were very much out in the open. Maybe his lack of attractive features even before the loss of his eye had made it difficult for him to relate to others, or reports of his tight rule in Austria shaped the views of his contemporaries. But it's quite clear that nobody very much liked him. Well, maybe his wife liked him. She gave him 21 children. No, on second thoughts, she may have had even more reason to resent him than the Austrian nobles. Whether they liked him or not, the Austrians and the other Habsburg forces did follow him in his pursuit of King Adolf that ended in the victory at Göllheim. And the electors too got over their reservations and elected him king just before the battle. But astute politician that he did not insist on that this election made under duress and in the presence of only some of the electors was the final one. A second confirmation election took place on July 27, 1298, now in the presence of all electors minus the Bohemian king. Albrecht was unanimously chosen and, like his predecessor, he had signed all sorts of commitments to each of the electors, promising support in lawsuits, imperial lands, money and just general compliance. And like his predecessor, he believed that paper was patient. Who was not very patient was Pope Boniface VIII back in, well, not Rome, but in Anani. The Pope had to, as was now regularly the case, flee from the Eternal City and establish his court in the small but gorgeous town of Anani. These rather reduced circumstances did not stop Pope Boniface VIII to drive the concept of the imperial papacy to its absolute zenith. In his bull, Unam Sanctam, he stated that, quote, "It is necessary for salvation that every human creature be subject to the Roman pontiff." That meant he yielded not just the spiritual sword, but also the temporal. Kings are to be subordinates to the Holy Father, and, in fact, an emperor was no longer needed. Now, for Boniface to depose Adolf von Nassau and then elect Albrecht von Habsburg was an affront. Not that he had a particular fondness for Adolf or an animosity towards Albrecht. It was a question of rank and protocol. The electors should have first asked for papal permission before making the move. And when Albrecht's ambassadors humbly asked for confirmation of his new honour, Boniface responded, quote, "I am the King of the Romans. I am Emperor." Now, Albrecht, the actual king of the Romans, did not have either the resources or the political capital to refute the pope's claims. He was dependent on the pope, because only the pope could crown him emperor, and only as emperor could he get his sons elected and thereby ensure the continuation of his dynasty on the imperial throne. So he sent another set of ambassadors, asking now even more humbly what would appease his holiness. And the answer was simple. Yeah, the whole of Tuscany. The famous inheritance of the great Countess Matilda was still in dispute. And the pope thought now was the time to put this one to bed. A high price indeed. Now, being bullied by the pope was only one of Albrecht's preoccupations at this time. Albrecht was very much his father's son, and he was constantly on the lookout for opportunities to expand his and his family's lands. And this was a time where long-standing dynasties had a habit of dying out or falling apart, creating opportunities for an ambitious Habsburg to pick up some lands. The first opportunity was up in the far north. In 1296, Count Floris V of Holland, the son of one of the previous kings of the Romans, of William of Holland, was murdered by the nobles of his county. Floris's support for the peasants and his opposition to the aristocracy made him a folk hero, but also a dead folk hero. His son, John, died 3 years later, aged just 15, allegedly from dysentery. The county of Holland, together with Zeeland and Friesland, were now vacant fiefs. And instead of handing them to the closest relatives of the young count, well, Albrecht decided to, well, take them all for himself. Then there was still that Thuringia affair. Remember, Albrecht's predecessor, Adolf von Nassau, had called in the Margraviate of Meissen and had bought the Landgraviate of Thuringia from a guy aptly named Albrecht the Degenerate, who had been at war with all of his relatives. Now, Albrecht himself had not much of a legal claim in that game, but still went for it, demanding the whole of the Wittiner lands for himself. None of that made him popular with the electors. And he also now had to deal with a new Archbishop of Trier, who happened to be the brother of the deposed King Adolf of Nassau, who had died in a battle against Albrecht. Mounting opposition from the electors and outlandish demands from the Pope meant Albrecht needed an ally. And that ally was King Philip the Fair of France. Fair in this context means pretty rather than just. Albrecht had become close to the handsome Philip at the time King Adolf von Nassau had allied with King Edward of England to attack the French. And that initial, my enemy's enemy is my friend relationship, warmed further when Albrecht became king. The two rulers met on the border between their realms and agreed an alliance. Under that alliance, Albrecht's son Rudolf, who we call Rudolf III to distinguish him from his uncle and grandfather, was to marry Blanche, the daughter of King Philip. Now, normally, the bride was to bring the dowry, but the relative power between the two monarchs meant it was the groom's father who had to put up the goods. The Landgraviate of Upper Alsace and the county of Fribourg in modern-day Switzerland were to be given to Blanche as an appanage. And then, this the county of Burgundy, the Franche-Comté, was to become French. And that was a major concession. The county of Burgundy had been part of the empire since the days of Conrad II, and the county had become imperial land when Barbarossa married Beatrix of Burgundy. Giving Burgundy up was not exactly a way to be a Semper Augustus, an always augmenter of the realm, as his title proclaimed. Moreover, a new border between France and the Empire was agreed, which followed the Maas River, and again handed over some imperial territory to France. Albrecht had brought the electors along for the negotiations to legitimize this transfer of imperial territory. But he failed to get them on board. They left the conference in protest, claiming Albrecht was throwing away imperial lands for his own purposes. Albrecht still went ahead and ratified the treaty with or without electors, at which point another war between king and electors was unavoidable. But this time the electors did not depose the king and elect a new challenger. As it happened, they could not muster much resistance after all. Albrecht quickly mobilized his imperial forces and, most importantly, the free and imperial cities, who became more and more the key to royal power. Ironically, the reason the electors could not muster much resistance was because their resources had been depleted during the fight against Adolf von Nassau which was the fight that had brought Albrecht to power. And the French alliance worked out like a dream as well. Pope Boniface's assertion that all power lay with the papacy and that every king was to bow to him did go down like a lead balloon with King Philip the Fair of France. And other than Albrecht, he was able to do something about it. He sent 2,000 mercenaries under the command of his close advisor Guillaume de Nogent to Italy. His troops stormed the papal palace at Anani and arrested the Pope. In some accounts, the mercenary commander Sciarra Colonna slapped the Pope, though this is not confirmed. What is definitely true is that the Pope was made a prisoner and only came free when the citizens of Anani put pressure on the French garrison. Then the French withdrew. But Pope Boniface VIII and the Imperial Church were shaken to the core. Boniface VIII died a few months later from the aftershock. Another few years on, the papacy moved to Avignon to spend the next century under the watchful eye of a French garrison on the opposite shore of the Rhone River. And Boniface VIII relented on the question of imperial succession. He confirmed Albrecht's election and coronation as valid and promised to have him crowned should he make it to Rome. Now, as it happened, that never happened. Albrecht was instead occupied with another set of opportunities, and these were really big opportunities, even larger than the County of Holland or the Margraviate of Meissen. The first was the Kingdom of Hungary. The dynasty that had started with Arpad, who led the Hungarians into the Pannonian Basin in the 9th century, had finally gone extinct. Royal power in Hungary had been eroded for some time, and the last two kings, Ladislaus IV and Andrew III, had lived a peripatetic life whilst the great noble clans controlled the kingdom. But still, Hungary was a rich and historically a hugely powerful kingdom. Albrecht had been involved in Hungarian affairs for decades already as he captured castles and territories along the Austro-Hungarian border from rebellious nobles. In the civil war that followed the death of the last descendant of Arpad, Albrecht was initially a contender, alongside the Anjou of Sicily and our old friend, Wenceslas II, the King of Bohemia. However, Albrecht had to realize that he was unlikely to ever capture Hungary against the opposition of both of them. So he sided with the Anjou, almost certainly in the hope of being rewarded should this side ultimately win. And whilst Hungary became less of an opportunity, another prospect appeared due to a series of freak events. Now, Wenceslas II of Bohemia had been looming large over imperial politics since the death of Rudolf I. But the empire was only one of his areas of interest. Another one was Hungary, as we've just heard, and finally, there was Poland. In Poland, the Piast dynasty had fragmented into a dozen duchies under a purely formal overlordship of the ruler of Krakow. Wenceslas, like his father Ottokar, took a strong interest in Polish affairs. I will not try to untangle the immensely complex political maneuvers against the various Piast dukes here. I did some of it in episode 134, if you're interested. What matters is that Wenceslas had managed to build a dominant position inside Poland, which included the Duchy of Krakow. He also married the daughter of the previous Polish king, Przemysl II, which allowed him to get crowned King of Poland in 1300. He also achieved the coronation of his son, the future Wenceslas III, as King of Hungary, though he only controlled part of the country. Still, by 1303, the power of the Bohemian ruler had become deeply uncomfortable, not just for Albrecht, but also for some of the imperial princes and the Pope. Pope Boniface declared for the House of Anjou as Kings of Hungary, and even though Boniface died shortly afterwards, papal support for the Anjou as Kings of Hungary remained firm. Albrecht then attacked Wenceslas in Moravia with support from the Anjou in Hungary. This campaign was unsuccessful, allegedly because the miners of Kutná Hora poisoned the water with silver dust. Still, Wenceslas II needed to open negotiations with Albrecht to break him out of the coalition with the Pope and the Anjou. Albrecht entered the negotiations with excessive demands, but still ended up with the return of the region around Eger, that's Cheb in Czech, and the Pleissenland. Not exactly a crown, but not a bad addition to his bulging property portfolio. Now, Wenceslas II did not see the final signing of the peace agreement. He died after a prolonged illness in June 1305. His crowns went to his son, Wenceslas III. And Wenceslas immediately gave up on Hungary and focused on Poland. There he faced opposition from Vladislav the Elbow High, one of the Piast dukes, and the man who, together with his son Casimir III, would reunite Poland. So, a mighty foe. Wenceslas III was also a sort of party prince, who surrounded himself with young men of a similar disposition whilst leaving the management of the kingdom to his brother-in-law, the Duke Henry of Carinthia. And on August 4, 1306, a mystery took place. King Wenceslas III of Bohemia and Poland was stabbed by an unknown assassin at Olmütz. The assassin was never found. And with this freak event, the Przemyslid dynasty that had ruled Bohemia for more than 400 years, well, was no more. Nobody had counted on this to happen. The Przemyslid kings of Bohemia had been a huge force in imperial politics for centuries, and none more so than in the time of Ottokar II and Wenceslas II. Bohemia was an immeasurably rich and tightly run political entity. No question, whichever clan was to gain possession of it would dominate imperial politics from this point forward. Now, the first to seize this opportunity was a man we have not heard of at all. How is that possible? 143 episodes with names after names after names after names, and you tell me there's a new one? Well, I'm really sorry, but there is. And the name is Henry. Henry, Duke of Carinthia. The reason you've not heard of him so far is that up until now, Henry of Carinthia was a sort of appendage to the Habsburgs. He was born the younger son of the Counts of Tyrol, who controlled the Brenner Pass from their castles in Innsbruck and Meran. Henry's sister was married to Albrecht I of Habsburg. And that came in very handy when in 1286 the decision about the Duchy of Carinthia came up. As you may remember, Carinthia had come under the control of Rudolf von Habsburg after his victory at Dürnkrut. Rudolf would have loved to pass Carinthia to his sons, as he had done with Austria and Styria, but he found strong opposition amongst the electors. So he gave it to this young guy Henry on the proviso that he would do whatever the Habsburgs wanted him to do. Well, Henry did. He fought with Albrecht at Göllheim and just generally made himself useful around the house. But then he was given the opportunity of a lifetime. He got to marry Anne, the daughter of King Wenceslas II of Bohemia, and with it came the governorship of Bohemia on behalf of the dissolute Wenceslas III. And then the most unlikely thing happened. Wenceslas III was murdered by an unknown assassin. And Henry just, well, he happened to be the right man at the right place. There were no male members of the royal line left. He is married to one of the female members of the family. He's in Prague, and he's already in charge of the place. So the Bohemian nobles elect him to be the new king. This royal bliss lasted, unfortunately, only a few months. His brother-in-law and former friend, King Albrecht of Habsburg, invades Bohemia. He besieges Henry, and he and his wife have to flee back to Carinthia. Now, Albrecht now forces the Bohemians to elect his son Rudolf III to be King of Bohemia. To add to the rather flimsy legitimacy of his ascension, young Rudolf married the widow of old King Wenceslas III. But things did not go smoothly. Some of the Bohemian nobles were reluctant to accept Rudolf, who they called King Porridge for his sensitive digestive system. They denied him access to the silver mines of Kutná Hora and forced him into a siege. And it was at this siege that Rudolf III's stomach finally burst, and with it ended the first attempt of the Habsburgs to capture the Bohemian crown. The Bohemian nobles recalled Henry of Carinthia, and this time he was better prepared to repel the subsequent attack by Albrecht I. At that point, Albrecht's forces were stretched mightily thin. Whilst his son was trying to gain control of Bohemia, the Wittins back up in Thuringia had regained their fighting spirit and inflicted a severe defeat on Albrecht's forces. But Albrecht was only 53, younger than his father when he took the throne. He may not have been pretty or charming, but he has been a very successful ruler in the chaotic context of his times, ruthlessly expanding the Habsburg lands. Give him another 10 years and the Habsburgs are in charge of a rectangular territory stretching from Strasbourg to Vienna to Dresden and Frankfurt, plus Holland. More territory than any of his predecessors held and containing the largest known reserves of precious metal in Europe. But, as the title of this episode indicates, Albrecht wasn't given another 10 years. I think I did say a few episodes back that part of the success of the Habsburgs was that they would act as a unit. Everyone, not just the ruler, but all the archdukes and archduchesses were working on the great project of Habsburg power. But it also said that there were exceptions, where rivalry and mistrust blew out into a violent conflict. And that is what happened on May 1st, 1308. You remember that Albrecht had a brother called Rudolf. Rudolf was their father's preferred son. It was this Rudolf who was initially to become king of the Romans, not Albrecht. And his father had tried to make Rudolf a duke, ideally the Duke of Swabia. But both projects failed mainly since Rudolf died in 1290. Rudolf had also initially been made joint Duke of Austria and Styria, but in 1283 the two duchies became Albrecht's sole possession, and with Rudolf's death so did the original Habsburg possessions in Swabia. Now all this wouldn't be a problem if Rudolf did not have had a son called Johann. Johann was born shortly before his father's death, and so by 1308 he is 18 years old, and he has neither a title nor land. His mother had been the daughter of King Ottokar II of Bohemia, so if anyone in the Habsburg family had a legitimate claim on the Bohemian crown, it was Johann, not Albrecht's son Rudolf III, he of the frail stomach. Johann was not happy about how things were taking shape. Albrecht still had 5 surviving sons. That meant there was one last chance for Johann, and that was if Albrecht would make him his Bohemian candidate, now that Rudolf III was dead. On April 30th, 1308, Albrecht came to Winterthur in the Habsburg lands. A great banquet was held, and to honour his nephew, Albrecht offered Johann a floral wreath. That tipped Johann over the edge. He was expecting a crown of silver, gold and precious stones, and instead all he got was some daisies. He rose and declared he would not be fobbed off with some flowers, and ran out. Now the next day, when Albrecht was on his way home, he crossed the river Reuss near Windisch. There Johann and his friends attacked. Johann rode up to his uncle the king and split his head without even saying a word. The murderers escaped, and Johann, now known as Johann Parikida, was never heard of again. He made appearances in literature, even gets to meet Wilhelm Tell in Schiller's play, but for history, he's lost. And so is Albrecht I von Habsburg, King of the Romans. He had never become emperor, which meant he had not been able to ensure the continuation of his dynasty. The electors were free to do what they now always did: deny the succession to the son of the latest incumbent. Instead, they chose another impecunious count. Will they ever learn? I hope you want to find out and tune in again next week. And I also hope you find me these 3 friends or family members, acquaintances, or just people on the street who you can turn into fans of the history of the Germans. Ideally, send them to the main podcast, but if they are only interested in some parts of the story, I have separate playlists about the Ottonians, the Hanseatic League, the Teutonic Knights, and for the current series, all released as separate podcast. The links are in the show notes.